Hi, I'm Philip Shepherd. It's my pleasure to welcome you to this amazing once-in-a-lifetime conference, and especially to the Meditation and Breathwork channel, which I'm proud to be sponsoring because meditation and breathwork are essential to my teachings. I'm the founder of the Embodied Present Process, or TEP, which is based on my two books and is taught worldwide. And here's one thing I believe about meditation and breathwork. You limit your experience of both if you imagine that your mind is just the thoughts in your head. Your mind permeates your every cell. Every stirring of energy within your body is an expression of it. So, if you wish to calm your mind, the most direct route is to develop the skills that enable you to feel the body's energy and ground it in the spaciousness of the present. That's what my work is about. If that appeals to you, I hope you'll check out my two presentations, one on this channel and one on the main stage. You might also be interested in a special offer exclusive to the Embodiment Conference to listen to one of my embodied meditations for yourself for free. You can find a link to the special offer in the description of this presentation or on the show notes. And now, enjoy the presentation.
I want to welcome you to the Embodiment Conference meditation series. And today we're going to be doing an interview with Julian Daizan Skinner Roshi. So Roshi, I'll give you a short introduction and then we will jump into the interview, if that's okay. Sure. Julian Daizan Skinner Roshi is the first Englishman to go to Japan and become a Roshi or Zen master in the rigorous Rinzai tradition of Zen. He spent over 20 years ago, he gave up a promising career as a scientist in the pharmaceutical industry, sold his house and gave all his money away and entered into a Zen monastery. Over many years of strict training in Japan and the West, Daizan Roshi received his Dharma transmission and permission to teach in both the Rinzai and the Soto lineages of Zen. That's quite an accomplishment. He has also undergone training as Enlightenment Intensive Master with Lawrence Noyes, leading student of the creator of the Enlightenment Intensives, Charles Berner. Daizan Roshi received his Inca from Shizan Miyamae
Roshi.
Of Gyokuryuji.
Gyokuryuji, that's right. Gyokuryuji,
which whom he continues to study to this day. Skinner Roshi, I want to welcome you to the Embodiment Conference.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's wonderful to be in your presence, and I appreciate the opportunity to explore in this kind of quote unquote interview of ours, and the title of this session is going to be The Zen of Embodiment. So why don't we just start there? What is the Zen of Embodiment?
Okay, thank you. That's a great place, I think, to launch it all off. Well, if I think about my own situation, I got kind of interested in, the inner journey when I was early mid-20s. I was fit, I was playing rugby, I was running marathons and half marathons and so on. And when I finally came to sit down and face the wall for half an hour, It was extraordinary how uncomfortable it was. The tensions and the misalignments were just absolutely there, front and center. It was almost entirely embodied experience, my legs gradually turning to gray rubber. So for me, that really set off a journey where I found a spiritual kind of home within Zen, but also over the 20 odd years I lived in Zen temples and monasteries, it was an ongoing quest and thread for me to find the bits and pieces that were there around working with the body. And all that culminated with my teacher that I study with now, who teaches in the tradition of Zen master Hakuin, very important Rinzai Zen master from about 250 years ago. And Hakuin was a very, very keen practitioner and got very sick in the process. He had a couple of very powerful, very transformative awakening shifts. And then I can sort of read you the upshot, his own sort of
yes, please.
His own, this is literally his own words. Before a month had passed, my heart overheated and scorched my lungs. My legs felt as cold as icy snow. I constantly heard noises in the ears as if I was walking along through a river valley. My liver felt weak. I was afraid of everything. My spirit was distressed and weary. Whether sleeping or awake, I saw illusions and visions. My armpits were constantly drenched with sweat and my eyes continually filled with tears. I searched out famous doctors and Zen teachers in every part of the country, but found no relief. So he's about 24 years old here. Okay, he's a young guy in the full vigor and prime of early life, and yet he feels like he's dying.
And this was in the midst of his practice, this quote that you remember?
Practice, yeah.
So it's like a dark night of the soul kind of period.
Basically, he's had a couple of fairly significant, life-changingly significant, what we would call in Japanese, kensho, which is like, ken is to see or to know, sure, who you really are or your true nature. So he's been through that and he's getting sicker and weaker to the point where he's running out of juice and thinking that he's on the slide down to death. Now, this is something that sometimes people might think that is old stuff or you know, history. My first Zen teacher, who I spent about 14 years with, has to basically live in a hermitage now, completely run out of juice energetically. He can only be in public about 2 weeks a year. It got to a point in the first Zen framework, the monastery I was living in, where of the six senior people running the place, five out of the six had serious energy depletion kind of problems. So this happens now.
These are from standard physical issues, or is it also part of the spiritual purification process?
So I think we could unpack that as when things kind of are opened up spiritually, there can be a tremendous sort of uprush energetically, consciousness-wise as well. And if that uprush isn't handled right, then it sort of weakens the lower, if you like. It's almost like you can get in a situation of robbing Peter to pay Paul, almost, in which the body's underlying physical integrity becomes undermined. People get weaker,
yes.
People get less able to do, less able to, as it were, play their part within the world, within society, within this realm we find ourselves. And Hakuin himself got in this state, 24 years old. So he goes on a journey trying to find anybody who can help him. And according to his story that we have translated there, he finds a hermit in the mountains, a little way outside of Kyoto, who teaches him a series of practices to, as it were, re-embody and revivify the system. Hakuin goes away for about 3 years and really works on this stuff and actually puts himself back together again. And becomes a notably empowered and energetic and grounded figure in his own teaching. Mm. Now he ends up teaching in a little tiny village temple at the foot of Mount Fuji. As the word gets out about this sort of enlightened Zen master teaching in this village, people start to gather. And over the months and years, more and more people come to the point where this little tiny temple is just full. There's no more space. And at that point, Hacquin starts to organize the students into little groups of three, and he basically sends them out into the landscape, and they find shrines, old shrines, or fishermen's huts, or some of them are camping out under trees, until you get the whole landscape around this village becoming one vast kind of freeform homespun training dojo. Wow. And only time it's ever happened, never happened before or since. Now, a lot of these
Sorry to stop you. The hermit that he studied with was a Zen master, or he was doing something else?
No, it seems there was, in that part of Kyoto, in kind of northeast Kyoto, at that time, there was a particular samurai, retired samurai, very rich guy, called Ishikawa Jōzen, who was very interested in Chinese culture, and particularly Chinese literature. Yes. And was kind of importing a lot of stuff. And he set up a kind of a, almost like a little miniature university called the Shisendo. You can still go and visit it over in Kyoto there. It's kind of like a Chinese culture center. And part of what they were studying there, it seems, is Chinese medical texts. This hermit was associated with this training center. And it seems that he was a real person and he would have learned some stuff in this milieu and then went off to live in a, it's actually an artificial cave. It was carved out of a cliff by rock cutters. He lived out there. It's not in the wilds or anything. Hacquin is always one for a good story. And the way he writes it, it sounds like this cave is at the far end of nowhere. It's not, it's an hour and a half's walk out of Kyoto, basically.
Like everything in Japan.
Yeah.
It's a train, there's a train station, there's a little bit of a walk, there's some steps to climb, and then you're there.
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah, very, it's very accessible. And actually the cave is has been largely quarried away. It's now just a little dimple in the rocks, but you can see where it was and so on.
Yeah.
But anyway, so Hacquin, he's got this community now living in very simple, very rough conditions. And some of his young guys start to get sick, you know, and he starts to teach them the practices that he learned from the hermit. And this becomes a very sort of central part of their training regime. And Hacquin develops essentially a scheme of practice that he calls the two wings of a bird, where one wing are practices which are designed to really to expand consciousness, to find the truth of things, if you like, to further the enlightenment project. And then the other wing are these practices which are about grounding, energizing the system so that you have, if you like, a vessel which is able to live out the truth of those insights so that you can live your best life and make a difference in the world as well, rather than have to run away and hide and not be able to serve and be of use.
So in a way, in other ways, to just kind of find the optimal experience of our vehicle in order to those the two wing, that's one wing, the embodiment basically.
That's
and
right.
The other would be the consciousness, the awakening of the consciousness.
That's right. Yeah. Beautiful. And so with this framework, Hacquin's students from this very freeform, very simple situation within a couple of generations had taken over the whole Rinzai Zen school. Every single major monastery was run by one of the guys who'd come out of this situation. And all the other lineages at that point had died out. So this system was very, very powerful, very effective. So the last 12 years or so, since I've been back from Japan, I've been basically sharing this architecture of practice with people in the West, dealing with the stresses and strains of, you know, our lives and so on. And it's
modern diseases of the Western man and woman.
Right. Tremendously disembodied in many ways, perhaps more than any other humans who've ever walked the earth. And it's been really extraordinary seeing how this has played out.
Well, that sounds like a beautiful place to kind of shift into this so-called architecture of Zen that you were talking about. Can you describe it for us? Can you maybe walk us through something?
You mean actually we try something out, or you know?
I'm open to anything, but first I would love to hear kind of the overview of what this practice is. Mm. Okay. Or whatever you can share from that.
Sure, of course, delighted. So we've got the full scheme laid out in a book I put together called Practical Zen, which is basically it's a sort of a course, a practice in which you can put all the elements together for yourself. Mm. Now, the basically the underlying principle under it all is a conception of the human organism as an energetic phenomenon. There's a, it's sort of taken as read that we have this sort of system of vitality that, that underlies the system. And then within that, that system of vitality, along with the sort of the mainstream of East Asian culture, has this principle that essentially energy or vitality follows the mind. So when the, when somebody's very, if you like, head-centered, then energetically things tend to go that way. People get very weak. When somebody is has developed what they call in Japan, hara. Now, you're an Aikido person. You know lots about all this sort of thing, I'm sure.
And I also lived in Japan for many years, too, so I know.
So you'll be very familiar. So this work is very much about cultivating the abdomen, you know, and the hara. So we have this English term, guts, which I think conveys it quite well, in that we have this sense of, you know, somebody who's got guts is somebody with courage. We talk about a gut feeling where there's that sort of intuition, that knowing that's not an intellectual knowing. We talk about a gutsy person where there's that sort of, you know, that see it through kind of grittiness and so on. And all of these are conveyed in this term hara. But the big different thing between Western culture as we have it now and this sort of thing we're talking about is this quality of hara, this quality of guts is seen as something that can be developed, can be cultivated. And when we do, it creates a sort of a grounded presence, a sort of a, even a kind of a charisma, a sort of an energy, which provides a foundation in which, well, an image that's been used by my teacher who worked with me in this is it's like when you put your energy and your effort into creating this, it's like you create the roots of a tree. And when the tree has deep and strong roots, then the tree can grow high safely. When we don't take care of the roots, the higher the tree grows, the more perilous it becomes. And sooner or later, there's going to be a problem.
Yes, that's beautiful. So when you're talking about guts, it's much more than just physical. There's an energy or a spirit that, that emanates or radiates from you. Excuse me, you'd mentioned charisma and a certain type of energy. There you can kind of feel it when you're in the presence of somebody who has developed or is quite stable or rooted in their hara.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm guessing that people who are interested in embodiment would find this kind of work very relevant, and the sort of thing that you do with the Aikido very, very relevant.
In Aikido and in embodiment, there's a lot of talk about hara. I have a notion that there, and I'm sure other people in the embodiment field are also talking about it. I have a notion that it's that there's an additional element to centering, what we call centering in Aikido or embodiment. That hara there's an extra dimensionality to it, no? Than just mere centering.
So we have this connection between the mind, if you like, consciousness, and the vitality or the energy. When we use the mind in certain ways, there's an energetic consequence. Now, there's a flip side to that as well. When things open up spiritually, if you like, when the awareness or the consciousness that we're actually all right, that actually we're home, that actually we are where we need to be, when that starts to open up, as we develop the energetic dimension and the energetic awareness within the system, we can actually, if you like, stabilize that insight through energetic means. Many people in many spiritual fields come into this place of if you like, coming home spiritually. But it can be fleeting. It can come and go and so on.
Just a glimpse, right?
When we've really got this grounding, this as you put it, centering, when that's really there, when we're really at home in that energetic dimension, this can become much more something that we can then bring into life. We can live it out more powerfully.
Beautiful. Okay, so we go from the energy to the hara, developing the hara. And you said there were other elements to this from your practical Zen manual that include this architecture.
So what we've got, I mean, you can sort of break it down in a number of ways, but the way we followed essentially follows Hakuin's own instructions as closely as we can. So he's basically got a series of practices. So on the insight side, or the consciousness expansion side, there are practices working with a question or a koan, working in with a silent awareness, working with the breath, all to, as it were, come into that place of non-separation, that place of our true home, if you like. And then on the other side, the grounding, the energy, and so on, he's also got a series of practices. It might make sense. We just jump in and have a little play. I don't know.
Oh, I'd love to. That'd be great, yeah. And even though this is recorded, if for anybody who's watching this recording, I'm sure that they can participate fully and experience what you and I would be experiencing.
Sure. Okay, well, we'll just do a little bit, eh? Just get a little feel. So if you can get yourself in a position where you're kind of relaxed and yet as upright and balanced as you can manage.
Okay.
So this practice in Japanese is called Nanso no Ho. Nanso means something like soft milk or soft cream, soft ointment.
Mm. Okay. Method of soft ointment.
I'm sorry.
The method of Nanso no Ho, the method of soft cream.
Exactly.
Yes.
So you're familiar with this one?
No, but I speak Japanese. I don't know all the Zen, I don't know a lot of Zen terms, but I do.
Good. All right. So if you close your eyes, let your body be relaxed, breathing through your nose if you can, your mouth if you need to. And then we just imagine on the crown of your head, you have a ball of this special soft healing ointment, in the form of a little ball, maybe the size of an egg or a squash ball, something like that. And this ointment milk, as it begins to melt, has the property of not only melting and running down over the surface of your body, but also down through your body. And so the heat of your head begins to melt this ointment. It turns to milk. It begins to slowly flow down over your forehead, melting down over the sides of your head, the back of your head, melting down through your brain. Slow, cool fingers ointment, just melting down and washing downwards any stuckness, melting down over your face, the sides of your head, down over the rear of your head, through your head, your brain, melting down through your throat, your neck, melting down through and over your shoulders, and down over your upper arms, and through your upper arms, through your chest, your upper back, melting down, and even more from your crown, pouring down through and over your body, through your arms, your elbows, your forearms, through and over your wrists, down through and over your fingers, and also down through your trunk, over your trunk, through and over your belly, your mid-back, downwards through your lower back, and even more melting down through and over your pelvis, your thighs, and all the way down, melting down, pouring down through and over your knees, your lower legs, down through your ankles, down through your feet, your toes, and imagining that your toes are hollow, beginning to fill with this ointment milk, this healing ointment milk, slowly filling inside your toes, slowly melting down, filling inside your feet, your heels, into your ankles, melting down, filling inside your calves, your shins, filling slowly all the way up to the level of your knees, filling inside your knees, slowly melting down, filling into your thighs, your lower thighs, melting down, filling inside your mid-thighs, your upper thighs, through your hips, melting down, filling into your pelvis, melting down, filling through your pelvis, your lower belly, to the level of your navel, and here it stops, so your lower body can feel filled, grounded, warmed, your upper body light, free, washed through. Just taking a few breaths here, just sensing how this is, so that this can become a body memory, so that you can connect with this alignment whenever you might want to. And then very gently swaying your body a little bit side to side. And when you're ready, allowing your eyes to lift. So this was one of the practices that Hakuin presented to his young monks when he was getting word that things were needing a little bit of extra help on the embodiment, the grounding, the energetic dimension of that practice.
Mm. Yeah, beautiful practice.
Nice.
It's like a cleansing or a mind-body hygiene, and yeah. but it definitely brings that kind of earthy, soft, gentle, earthy quality to it. Yeah, thank you for that.
Oh, you're welcome. So this has been quite a thread for me, really, over the years. In my own practice, I've found a lot of value and put quite a bit of energy into seeking out bodywork practices within the Zen places I've lived. things which look like yoga type practices. Sometimes you've probably come across in Japan yourself. Sometimes they call it Doin or Zen Taiso. You come across various names, but basically working with the physicality. And that's been a strong thread for me, having had such a shock in my early phase, really, of practice, at how out of condition I was to do anything serious in this.
Well, how out of meditation condition? Because you were an athlete. You were, like, if I understood you correctly, you were like a fine-tuned athlete on one level, quite embodied, but not in a Zen sense, not in a meditation sense.
Not at all.
When you made that shift. I had a similar experience, by the way, when I made the shift to my, I didn't do Zen in Japan. I was doing Aikido and I was dabbling in meditation on my own for quite some time. But then when I went to do my formal practice, and I had as a young meditator, I had a high opinion of myself, I suppose, having achieved a certain amount of skill in Aikido. But once I went to Buddhist meditation, it really was a whole nother story. And it was a very humbling experience, very similar to what you were describing.
I know it, absolutely, yeah. Well, did they have you sitting in Seizar, or were you cross-legged when you were?
In Japan, when I was doing Aikido martial arts, it was Seiza. Okay. Seiza, and in pretty hardcore physical trainings. But then when I went to do formal meditation, like on retreats, and I went to Burma for that.
Right.
It was the first, 3 months of intensive retreats was just a very humbling experience for two reasons. One, it took my body a long time to adjust to that practice, and it was a painful process. But the second was the mind. What I had developed in one sense, the Zan Shin and the focus and the concentration that I developed in the Aikido practice was very good, but it took some time before it translated to a formal mindfulness meditation practice. And again, it was a process, and it was a humbling process, and it was necessary. In a way, the practice itself broke me down to build me up all over again.
Well, you were doing it the serious way, eh? An hour sitting, an hour walking, an hour sitting, an hour.
That's right, yeah, that's right, yeah.
All day long.
Yeah, pretty much all day long. I mean, it's, if you count the meals and stuff, it was like 18 hours a day, but I think formally about 14 hours of schedule per day.
It's tremendously impressive.
Well, I mean, it changed the way I see, and I can just that's why I feel so connected with you, because it changed the way that I related to my physical training. And I was kind of an athlete and a martial artist my whole life, kind of growing up. And then I ran into the limitations there. I felt that what I was actually seeking was not to reach some type of physical excellence or mastery, but what was really calling me in the art was something beyond that. And that's the step that I had to make. And what I would love to ask you to talk about a little bit is, quite often this seems like a contradiction. You talked about the two wings of the bird, which is a beautiful metaphor. But sometimes mind and body, or consciousness and physicality, seem to be at odds, or a contradiction. Whereas what I've always felt from Zen is that they beautifully transform this into a paradox. And there is no separation.
Well, I think one of the wonderful manifestations of this is a properly laid out temple. When you back for many years, for probably 400 to 500 years, Japanese Zen was largely a sort of an esoteric tradition. There were lots of secret teachings, and there are still threads of that fairly active in the world today. And one of the secret papers that you receive at certain points in certain lineages is the layout of a temple. And a temple is laid out so the abbot's quarters are where the head should be. It's in the form of a body. You've got the meditation hall, the kitchen, the Buddha hall, and so on. And the main gate is where the genitals are. And so that's where you enter. And when you enter a properly laid out temple, the first people that you meet, the first physical manifestations are these guys called Nio, these statues. And you've probably seen them, I'm sure, and many of your listeners, I'm sure. They're typically super muscled, sort of Schwarzenegger steroid sort of manifestations of pure aggression. There are two of them, one with his mouth open, one with his mouth closed.
Yeah, of course, sure.
And there they are, right? They're the first things that you meet. And what they're showing you, what's there is that even pure aggression has a place within the within this temple, if you like. Nothing, no dimension of our being or our experience needs to be cut off or thrown away. But it's just, it's all got to find its right place. That's really our work. So for example, with our Neo, with our, you know, guys at the gate, what are they? They're essentially the bouncers. You want the meanest, nastiest things to basically to keep it safe for everybody so that what's going on inside can actually, everybody can be okay, you know?
It also occurs to me as like a hero's journey. When you actually enter into the esoteric schools, you're going to be challenged. Yeah. And in a way, they're like the gatekeepers. And if if you're not serious, if you waver in your intention and commitment, you're going to falter there.
Yeah,
exactly. In a way they're enemies, but at a certain point they become your allies. I would suspect.
Exactly, 100%. And you see this imagery again and again. So, for example, in a properly laid out Zendo or meditation hall, right in the center, you've got the archetypal figure of wisdom, Monju, as he's called in Japanese. Mm-hmm. So the form that you'll find in Zen really across the board is he's kind of like a very soft figure, almost like a young boy, almost androgynous, not very male or anything. And he's sitting in meditation, or sometimes he's got a sword in his hand, and he's sitting on a kind of a lion. And the lion is big and muscled and powerful. And yet the lion is kind of turning, and very frequently he's looking up at Monju with almost like this kind of admiration or deep, deep kind of respect or even love. And so you've got Monju, this embodiment of essentially wisdom, of non-dual or non-separative wisdom. And he's carved in such a way that his robes kind of blend into the lion. You can't really see where Monju ends and the lion begins. Yeah, and so the lion, all those kind of instinctual forces, those forces of negativity, the aggression, the animal level stuff becomes, if you like, our vehicle. It's actually, that's where Monju's going to be. That's where he sits. That's where he's going to, and there's no separating the two. So yes, and that's absolutely there, right in the center of the meditation.
And the body is in service of the enlightened wisdom, of the awakened consciousness, rather than the body in our instincts kind of controlling things and us and our minds being in service of that, it flipped.
That's right. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. And so much of the process of the work that we're doing, I feel, is really a matter of making friends with the dark side, if you like, and letting it come into the light. And when it comes into the light, if we don't act it out, run with it, nor on the other hand, squash it back down again, then it has the chance to untwist. And that pure aggression, if you like, can become the gatekeeper. That pure animal level, whatever it is, survival stuff, can become the vehicle. And so there's this... probably I'm not alone in saying, I'm pretty sure there was nothing much going on in Hitler that, you know, hasn't, you know, found a form in here at times. But fortunately, maybe I've at least had a little bit of an opportunity to develop a little bit of different relationship to it so that it can find its, hopefully its true place rather than get put in the service of something wholly negative and dark.
Yeah, and that's a beautiful example, because if the ego, it's kind of, you know, you mentioned Hitler, we could make, it's very easy at this point to make the Darth Vader move. If the ego forces awakened consciousness to be in service of it, then it takes on a shadow, it takes on kind of a Darth Vader shadow, or it's, and especially if it has power, it imposes that power on other people. Whereas if we go through this transmutation, this transformation, which is part and parcel of I can't say complete spiritual path because I suppose it's endless, but part and parcel of mature spiritual development, then in that sense, the ego, which fundamentally is not bad, it's just limited, the ego is in service of our awakened consciousness.
That's right.
Or the body, or our instincts for that matter.
Mm, yes, exactly. I think there's a kind of a realignment can happen in which we, we produced a book about a year ago called Rough Waking. And it's basically, we do a bunch of work with people in the prison and homelessness sphere. One of my teacher students was on death row in Japan, and he was executed a year or two ago, but he left a sequence of pictures which demonstrate, the spiritual unfolding. And I want to show you one of them right here. Can you see? So it's a split picture. So on this side, you've got an ordinary, humble, traveling monk, just like a beginner, a novice. Yes. And on this side, you've got a sort of a divine or a bodhisattva figure. We can take that on. That there can be a sense of, we remain an ordinary, fallible, limited human being, prey to all of that stuff. And at the same time, we can have a foothold in something that's utterly boundless and extraordinary. And that humanity, when it's, I think, as you very much, very clearly put it there, can, as it were, come into the service of that which is utterly beyond the human.
Well, can I ask you a little bit about 2020? Because it occurs to me that these ferocious demons that we meet at the gate, what were their names again?
The Neo.
Yeah. So these kind of archetypes, or these icons, these figures that we meet, which are symbolic, but also they represent something very real. It seems like this, collectively, humanity is going through a gate.
Yeah.
In 2020. In many different ways.
Sure.
And how do you work with this? What's coming up for you that is kind of on a collective level that you feel that we need to help us transform through this process rather than collapse down into our more basic instincts?
Yeah. Well, if we take it on an individual level, and then, I think some of the societal stuff comes into a particular type of focus. So when somebody comes to, as we say in Zen, ekko hensho, to turn the light within, to face themselves, as you did, for example, when you went to Burma, then lo and behold, you start to see some pretty ugly stuff, painful stuff, fearful stuff, negative stuff.
Right. Then, as a necessary part of the purification.
Because we can't deal with any of this in the abstract. It's only as it arises that it has the chance to untwist. Now, what we saw on a societal level was essentially the whole world, near enough, was put on about a 4-month retreat with no preparation. People were just thrown into that situation. Suddenly. Lo and behold, up comes a lot of anger, up comes a lot of frustration, up comes a lot of fear. Now, we
sorrow, loneliness.
Unfortunately, an opportunity has been to some degree missed in that as that stuff comes up, it hasn't been, people haven't been given, I feel, enough of a framework around how to handle that. And so
that's due to leadership.
It spilled over into rioting, into societal level stuff, natural enough, probably utterly predictable. So we stand in need of figures, probably at a governmental level, who can actually help to point people, if this is going to carry on much longer, to point people in the direction of as this stuff arises, that's not a bad thing. That's actually an opportunity.
Right.
And then how to deal with that opportunity. And most of us probably won't get many 4-month retreats in our lives. Okay, so this potentially on this whole society, whole world level, is really extraordinary. And the jury's still out as to whether the positives and the negatives, how they're gonna balance out. But I'm hopeful. And I think we are certainly, and you know, I'm certainly seeing this in my personal interactions, people seem to be asking important questions, actually really reflecting on what really this time we have is best spent doing. That seems to be really resonant right now. People have had this chance to, as it were, get off the wheel for a little bit. You know, with a lot of, you know, potentially fear and anger and so on arising within the mix. So we'll see how that all plays out. But I'm hopeful.
Yeah, I'm hopeful too. And, you know, basically, I mean, from your experience working with your students and working with the aspects of society that you're working with, what would be your best advice to give to somebody when we're facing these demons without realizing that they're
yeah,
we're all going through a transformational process?
Well, that's the problem, really. It's like it's the unconsciousness is our enemy. When we can't see that this stuff arising, essentially, for example, anger, whatever that is, anger about how I've been treated by the society or by my parents or whatever it is, so that anger arises. Now, the easiest thing in the world is to, as it were, identify with that anger. I am that anger, that is me, and that needs redressing. I need to get out there and you know, make my mark. Now, if we can, rather than that, if we can, as it were, start to just study the anger, see the anger, very challenging to do, but if we can do that, then the anger becomes like the weather. Okay, the weather, it's a stormy day, it's a sunny day, the weather is the weather. But through doing that, then that anger can now begin to untwist. And it's not to say that things that have happened in the past aren't wrong, you know, and this is not to do with becoming some kind of doormat or some kind of, you know, passive person. But when we become able to, as it were, see that anger, recognize that anger, make friends with that anger without, on the one hand, being a slave to it, nor squashing it out of vision again, then that energy behind that anger becomes available for us to live more fully, more creatively, in such a way that we can perhaps even redress those wrongs that were the initial source of that anger without, as it were, fueling the fire necessarily any further. And we've got an opportunity to do this. And your important work with this conference is a prime example of the sort of thing that people are doing, putting together, so that this kind of opportunity can get recognized and can be, if you like, built on. And so I appreciate very much your vision your intention behind what you're doing.
It's very beautiful. And I appreciate very much what you said, because it occurs to me that, you know, well, like a good Zen Roshi, it's very Zen, because in a way what you're saying, let's say we take something like anger, but it could also be sorrow or regrets or revenge or all of jealousy, you know, these defilements that can arise in the mind and the hearts and the bodies of us all. We neither indulge them, nor suppress or push them back, nor deny.
Yeah,
which is kind of the three things that the ego does. You know, it's we don't indulge, or when we're aware we're indulging, we stop indulging. We don't deny, and we don't repress. And it reminds me that in Zen, there's a negation, and then what's left, whatever's left, is it creates the space for transformation to happen.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, 100%. And the beautiful thing is, you know, we can be carrying this stuff around for 5, 10, 20 years, but it doesn't take 5, 10, 20 years for it to untwist.
Right.
It does take some time, but it's not like a, you know, a huge marathon process necessarily.
And that's such an important message. That's such good news to really receive. Yes. Wow, beautiful. Listen, Roshi, before we have about six more minutes here, and I'm just curious, because you spent quite some time in Japan. I also did. And, you know, for the past 50, 60 years, the Asian awakening enlightenment traditions have kind of moved into the West. True, and yeah. And there's certain integration happening. But I would love to hear, how do you find bringing these traditional Japanese Zen practices into the West for the modern and postmodern man and woman who are living in a very different cultural context than which these came out of?
Yeah. It's such a good question. And it's an ongoing question for me. Mm-hmm. Even when I lived in Japan, people used to ask me about this, because even in Japan, people basically, what it came down to was, how can living such a hard life have anything to do with finding happiness? How does that work? You know, sure. Just couldn't get it at all. And even more so over here. I mean, the sort of way that we lived just wouldn't even be possible in the West. So when I came back from Japan, the one thing that was clear was it wasn't going to work to try to create a little sort of imported bit of a little island of traditional Japan in the middle of the UK. That clearly wasn't going to be a relevant response to what was needed. So it was, how can we do this? How is this going to work? And so I've been working with lay practitioners over the last 12 years. I created a training where I a professional, externally validated training for people to become yoga teachers. And I created another one for people to become meditation and mindfulness teachers, with the idea being that people could make a living doing this sort of stuff, and have sufficient time for their own journey within a sort of a lay context, so they could make that work. And we now have about 300 Zen yoga teachers out in various parts of the world doing this, and we have about 300 Zen meditation and mindfulness teachers doing the same kind of thing. And so we've kind of created a framework that way. So these people have a means of doing okay. You know, nobody's driving around in gold-plated Rolls Royces, but they're making a living, and it's in alignment with their spiritual intentions, and it's also, as it were, gives some space and time within their daily framework for their own growth and development and so on. So that's sort of been the structure as it's kind of evolved over the last 12 years. And it seems to work. I mean, it's still a journey, and it could take 100 years, I feel, for this to fully mature and find its true relevance within Western society. But that's where we've got up to so far.
Yeah, but basically you're bringing the traditional, in a way, timeless wisdom of Zen and Buddhism, and your incorporation is not really the right word, but you're also meeting the West where it's at with its values in a way that's ethical, and it doesn't compromise the deep value of Zen Buddhism, but somehow brings it together in a way that Westerners can also meet it without having to become Japanese in a way that maybe you and I did when we lived in Japan.
Well, that's the intention exactly. Yes. And you know, it's all evolving. We'll see how it goes. I mean, all you can say is so far so good, I guess.
Well, Sensei, Roshi, where would somebody go to find that training? Your website is zenways.org.
That's
is that correct?
Right. Yeah, and all the information's on there.
Great. They can probably go under Zen Study and find there's teachers training, etc. There. I'm looking at the website right now. So fantastic. So zenways.org. Roshi, we've kind of come to the end of our time here. Is there any final words of wisdom you would like to share on the Zen of embodiment?
Pretty good on wisdom then. But I mean, I appreciate very, very much what you're doing. And thank you so much for inviting me to be a little part of it, and you know, wishing you great, great success going forward. And I really appreciate the way that your whole structure and organization. You've taken this online so that it can carry on regardless of the conditions in the world. And that kind of creative sort of resilience, I think, is what we're going to need plenty of in the next sort of months and years.
I agree. Well, thank you so much, Roshi. I appreciate your time and your wisdom. And thanks for sharing it with us.
Well, thank you, Miles. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you too. All the best.
Bye now.
Goodbye.